This episode of the Art of Manliness podcast is brought to you by Design Crowd. Design Crowd is a website that helps startups and small businesses outsource or crowdsource custom graphics, logos, and web design from over 500,000 designers around the world. Check out designcrowd.com/manliness. That's designcrowd.com/manliness to learn more and receive a special $100 VIP offer when you start your next project. Or simply enter the discount code manliness when posting a project on Design Crowd. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. So for the past several years, you'd be hard-pressed to scroll through your Facebook feed or Instagram feed, especially in the summertime, without seeing some of your friends posting pictures of themselves at the finish line of a mud run or obstacle course race. Events like the Warrior Dash, Spartan Race, Tough Mudder have become well-known parts of the modern recreational scene, and many of you listening have probably done one yourself. But why exactly have obstacle course races, also known as OCRs, exploded in popularity in recent times? Why do millions of affluent suburbanites pay as much as $200 to have their bodies bruised and banged and sometimes subjected to extreme cold, electrical shocks, and even tear gas? Well, my guest today has spent the past few years exploring that question, and he's made a documentary sharing the answers he's uncovered. His name is Scott Keneally, and his documentary is called Rise of the Sufferfest. And in today's show, Scott and I discuss how the little-known origins of obstacle course racing can be traced to a farm in England, how an enterprising businessman turned that idea into a multi-billion dollar industry, and the cultural forces that have provided the soil for obstacle course races to grow so rapidly. We also discuss the criticism levied to obstacle course racing and what Scott thinks the future holds for OCRs. Really fascinating podcast. If you're a fan of obstacle course races, after the show, be sure to check out the show notes at aom.is/sufferfest for a link to the documentary on iTunes, as well as other resources to delve deeper into this topic. All right, Scott Keneally, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, man.
So you just come out with a new documentary about obstacle course racing called Rise of the Sufferfest. And this is an interesting topic for a documentary. What led you down the path of exploring things like Warrior Dash, Tough Mudder, Spartan Race, etc.?
It was a bit of a wayward journey, to be honest. I'm a journalist, and I kind of approached it initially as I just thought I'd write a one-off comedic essay about doing a Tough Mudder, and from the perspective of a beta male, like a self-proclaimed wimp who trains up and tackles the horrors of a Tough Mudder and writes a funny essay about it. So my background, or my heart, is in like kind of, I guess, confessional storytelling. But while I was doing a little bit of background research into the penny for that essay, I stumbled upon a little-known scandal surrounding the origins of Tough Mudder. There's a lawsuit between Tough Guy and Tough Mudder, and I very quickly thought that there's a very compelling story there about IP theft, and it had this whole kind of social network vibe to it. So I kind of reinvented myself as an investigative journalist and pitched a story to Ed Magazine. And after about a year of reporting and writing and rewriting, it landed on the cover of Outside. That led to an opportunity to work with 60 Minutes, developing a segment about obstacle course racing. And at that point, I was so deep into this world and so fascinated by what I had seen that I thought maybe I should just keep stick with this. I always loved telling stories. I always loved film. So it was kind of a natural fit to try to tell this story about this community and this phenomenon with film.
So let's talk about the industry of obstacle course racing, because this is something that didn't really exist 10 years ago. There's probably a few, but it's just blown up in the past 10 years. Can you give us sort of a bird's eye view of what the industry looks like? I mean, the size of it and how fast it's grown in the past decade?
In 2009, I think there were maybe an estimated 50,000 people who were running one of these types of events. You know, maybe 7,000 people, 8,000 people over in England doing Tough Guy. But it wasn't really until Tough Mudder came along and Warrior Dash and Spartan Race in 2009, 2010 that it really kind of exploded. And, you know, it's hard to get real actual numbers of the number of unique participants per year. But I would estimate that there's, you know, upwards of 5 to 7 million worldwide who will do one this year in 2016. So we're seeing like massive explosive growth over a very, very short period of time.
Man, that is nuts. And there's also not just the big races. There's a lot of small regional ones or local ones that have started as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are there are thousands, literally thousands of different races across the world. And, you know, we hear obviously about the biggest ones, but there are all sorts of local, really amazing small community races that, that people just put on out of passion. So yeah, there's a lot of opportunity to explore different types of experiences and brands.
Right. So let's talk about one of the smaller ones that most people don't know about, but you make the argument that this was the race that started it all. The inspiration for this obstacle course racing explosion we've seen in the past 10 years, it's called the Tough Guy. It's in England, and it was started by this really eccentric guy with a handlebar mustache named Billy Wilson, also known as Mr. Mouse. Can you tell us a bit about Mr. Mouse and this Tough Guy race, how it started and why it started and when it started?
It started back in 1987 in January. It's in the Midlands of England, and so it's very, very cold that time of year. And it started off very simple. It was a cross-country course with lots of water obstacles, which of course were miserable because it's January in England, hay bales, and over the years it really gradually grew organically and built. He built bigger obstacles, and it kind of evolved naturally. He'd just come up with these crazy ideas and execute them, and in 1999, he added electricity to the course, which was, you know, pretty unheard of. I mean, what's so interesting about this is we take it for granted that Tough Mudder has electricity on a running course, but you know, 15 years ago, that is absolutely insane, and was so far out there, and he got so much flack for it. People really thought he was nuts. And so, you know, why he did this, you know, he has a military background, and he thought it was a fun way for people to get into shape, and also, you know, he wants to teach people about war and remind people of the horrors that, you know, our ancestors have gone through. I think part of that is, like, somewhere he believes that if we experience the horrors of war, we may be less inclined to go to war. You know, as you know, these days, very few of us no expectation that any of us will ever have to fight in war. So he's giving us kind of a taste of these horrors, so we have maybe more empathy, more understanding for you know, the struggle.
Right. And how did it inspire Tough Mudder? Because you talk about it earlier that there was this sort of IP battle between Tough Guy and Tough Mudder. Can you give us a little bit of the story there and the controversy?
Sure. So Will Dean, the CEO of Tough Mudder, was a Harvard Business School graduate, and he reached out to Mr. Mouse and said that he wanted to help Tough Guy essentially expand to the US and do a business school study. And so he, you know, got some intellectual property, if you want to call it that, from Mr. Mouse. And he, you know, didn't work with Tough Guy to bring it to the US. He instead started Tough Mudder in the USA. And so Mr. Mouse felt like he was, you know, had been ripped off, and that Will had infiltrated his company and stolen trade secrets, and Will obviously saw it differently, and he was sued, and they settled after a pretty bitter legal battle, and they settled for $725,000 that Will paid to Tough Guy. And, you know, at the time, Tough Mudder was a pretty small brand, so that was a lot of money, but, you know, within a couple of years, Tough Mudder became a $70 million brand, and Tough Guy at this point is still just kind of hanging on.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Why is that? Why is it the race that started all the races? And why has it not done so well while others have done so well?
I mean, a lot of it's Mr. Mouse, really. I think he's the... First of all, he has no real good commercial awareness or marketing sense. And it's not really what he's after. I don't think his end goal is to make a lot of money off this. I mean, it's not. He'd like to reach people through this experience. And so, you know, the branding is kind of all over the map. It's not that scalable because it's a permanent course on his farm. So it's not like he is running these races all around the world. And, you know, quite frankly, like, if from a business standpoint, when you look at that farm, I mean, Mr. Mouse doesn't use a computer. He doesn't have very many MBAs in that office, to say the very least. He doesn't have any. It's a real, like, kind of mom and pop shop over there. It's really the charm. It's what I love about the event, is it feels very raw and old school and not commercial. And, you know, that's what I really gravitated towards. It felt like a throwback to another era altogether. So, yeah, you know, he's not marketing savvy, and he really never could have scaled this thing up.
Yeah, I thought it was funny in the documentary you talk about there's a Tough Guy newsletter, but it's an actual physical newsletter. It's sent in the mail, no email marketing, and he just writes about his donkeys and why donkeys are great.
Yeah, the jelly leg news. It is so bizarre. There are all these stories that kind of have nothing to do with the... So whereas, I mean, you look at like Tough Mudder, they have social media campaigns, they have millions and millions of Facebook followers. Tough Guy at this, after 30 years almost, and obviously Facebook's only been around for 6 years, Tough Guy has like 35,000 followers. They don't really have any understanding of how to use social media to leverage it for their own good. Yeah, the Jelly Leg News is this quarterly newsletter that he, you know, he said that he spent $60,000 on postage 1 year recently to send it out to people. And gets it and they're like, what the hell is this? So it doesn't really, but it's, you know, again, part of the charm. It's very quirky. The man is like wildly eccentric. He's just stripped right out of like a Daniel Day-Lewis movie.
Right. Yeah. He's sticking to his principles. It's the principle of the thing. So let's talk about this, because this is what your documentary is about. You're trying to figure out why obstacle courses are so popular. I mean, I've done them before. We've talked about this because you interviewed me for the documentary. I've done obstacle course races. In fact, I just did one last weekend called Conquer the Gauntlet here in Tulsa. And whenever I'm doing them, there's always this weird existential moment when I'm in the middle of the race, doing a really hard obstacle, climbing under barbed wire, and there's smoke, and I'm thinking, I paid $100 to do this. When you talk big picture, we'll get into the details later on, but what are the big driving forces that have made obstacle course racing so popular?
I think, you know, part of it is it's hard to, like, if there were no photos, if there's no Facebook and no ability for people to post photos, I think you would see much, much lower numbers. So I think social media, by and large, is a big motivating factor. The ability to brag and show your friends that you're this brand of tough. You know, granted, there'd still be people, as there were 20 years ago doing Tough Guy, there's still going to be that segment of population that wants to push themselves like this. But the ability to humble brag is, I think, a better. And then, you know, I think a lot of people are realizing they're missing something in their life. We've created these, you know, digital worlds in which we spend so much time looking in screens, and we're not really connected to earth. We're not outside. We're not working with our hands. We're not overcoming challenges. I mean, it seems like the whole, by design, modern life is, you know, we're working to remove every single obstacle from, like, you know, groceries delivered to your door. You know, it seems like everything is pushing us towards not having any kind of challenge. And I think that ultimately people feel unfulfilled. And so when they do these things and they have this kind of sense of achievement crossing the finish line, you know, it's kind of a revelatory experience for them. I know it was for me.
Yeah, but why not marathons or weight training? What is it about the obstacle course race that you feel that you get a sense of achievement that you can't get with other activities?
Yeah, I mean, marathon running is, I think, boring. Sorry to all you runners out there. Boring, let's just say boring in comparison. It's not boring compared to other things, but I think people want to be in shape, but they want the experience of getting into shape to be fun. And, you know, these things are like adult playgrounds. You get to, you know, there are some obstacles, like, you know, Tough Guy has these massive A-frames that are, they look rickety, they feel old. And here you are climbing up over these 40-foot behemoth obstacles and walking on ropes across them and, you know, diving into mud pits. I mean, it just feels like we're playing, you know, Cowboys and Indians as kids.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. All right, if you're like me, you hate shopping for clothes because it takes a lot of time and also can be pretty confusing trying to figure out what goes with what. If that's you, you need to check out 5/4 Club. You sign up for the service, pay $60 a month, and each month they're going to send you a box of clothing worth $120, stuff you can't get anywhere else. And what's great, the clothes they send you go together. And as you continue with their service, do it month to month, they're going to build on the wardrobe that you've been acquiring through 5/4 Club. It's really easy to sign up. When you sign up, you pick your style profile, classic, casual, forward, or mix. And I'm a classic guy, so I get a lot of plain white pocket tees, Henleys, button downs, jeans. As it's getting colder, there's some more cold weather clothing, so long sleeve shirts, things like that. And again, it's just $60 a month. Shipping is free, delivers directly to your doorstep. But I got an offer for Art of Manliness listeners that you can't get anywhere else. If you go to 54club.com and use promo code manliness at sign up, you're going to get two packages for your first order for just $60. So that's $60 for $240 worth of clothing. Again, 54club.com, promo code manliness for $240 worth of clothing for only $60. Offer expires at the end of September, so hurry. Also by Health IQ. Health IQ advocates for a health conscious lifestyle. They believe the best way to improve the health of the world is to celebrate individuals who make healthy choices. What Health IQ does is they use science and data to negotiate for lower rates on life insurance for individuals who are making healthy choices in their life. Many people don't realize they can get a lower rate due to their health conscious lifestyle, which can include swimming, weightlifting, cycling, eating right, etc. So what you do is you go to healthiq.com, you fill out some questions about your lifestyle, how often you exercise, how many home cooked meals do you eat a week, how much sugar you're eating, et cetera. And they're going to be able to negotiate a lower rate on your life insurance if you show that you are living a healthy life. To learn more about Health IQ and their special insurance rates for the health conscious people, just go to healthiq.com/manliness. That's healthiq.com/manliness. And now back to the show. And what's the breakdown in gender and obstacle course races? Is there more men than women who take part in these things?
Yeah, again, all the numbers are really kind of hard to get real stats, but I believe it's around 35% female. I looked at this as a masculinity crisis. You know, that's one of the things that I explore in the film. And yeah, I think for a lot of men, this is a chance to do men thing, you know, do manly things that they don't really ever get a chance to do. But it doesn't really explain why there are so many females doing this. So there's obviously, it's not just a masculinity crisis. There are a lot of women in mud.
Yeah, well, so what is driving the women then, if it's not just about men not feeling manly?
I think, you know, some of the other things would be, you know, just a loneliness and a disconnection that we feel in the digital age. Like, we're very, very connected, but we're not really that connected. We don't do things in groups. We don't share communal experiences. We interact a lot through the internet. And I think when, you know, there's this maybe longing for social, real-time human interaction. So that kind of community and camaraderie is a big draw for a lot of people.
Right. And going back to this whole masculine crisis you talked about, that was one of the threads throughout your documentary. You were talking about how when you were about to have your son, or you had your son, you wanted to make sure, you had this moment where like, am I manly? Am I going to be a good role model or father for my son? As you did these races, did it help you capture that feeling? Did it help you become a better man?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's a point in the film and in my life when a few things hit me at once. I had failed miserably on a crowdfunding campaign to raise money for this film. And then on that day that the campaign ended, I ended up quitting a Spartan race, a 3-mile Spartan race, totally my spirit broken, burpees and had kind of broken me. And I just didn't feel like I could go on. I didn't feel like I could finish a 3-mile race. I was 2 miles into it and I was just gutted. And so right after that, I find out that I'm going to become a dad, and I was terrified. You know, like I couldn't finish a race. I couldn't make this dream of making this movie happen. And I felt like, and now I'm going to become a dad. And just that fear is what really kind of motivated me to want to at least steel up mentally and physically, by, you know, training and going to CrossFit and taking my physical health more seriously and, you know, trying to instill some grit in myself and take on some of these races and conquer them so I could feel more capable and competent as a man. So I would say these races definitely for me changed my life in a really great way. The thought that as I quit that 3-mile Spartan race, the thought that one day, not in a year and a half, I would go out to the desert outside Las Vegas and in 24 hours, 50 miles at a Tough Mudder, was, you know, incomprehensible to me, to that man quitting that Spartan race. And I think it's really only because of these kinds of events and my for them, you know, they kept, and the fear of fatherhood, all that kind of, I guess, transformed me.
And are you still doing them today? Are you a regular Sufferfest attendee?
Yeah. And that, you know, that's one of the, for me, the beauties of these events is that they happen all year round. So, you know, I probably do about one a month. And I like just having on the calendar that I can look forward to and train up for. So right now I'm training for my second crack at the world's toughest mudder, which is in November. And, you know, I'm running and doing CrossFit specifically be ready for that event. So I can't foresee a time when I would quit these, and I look forward to doing them with my son someday.
Right. So just so everyone knows, I do provide a bit of dissent in the documentary, but I do the obstacle course races, and I enjoy doing them. I'm just sometimes curious about, like, why am I doing this? What's the cultural thing that's driving me to do this? I mean, I'm ambivalent about obstacle course racing. I'm trying to be thoughtful about why I'm doing this whole thing. And for more criticism about obstacle course races, recommend you all check out an article that my wife's uncle, who lives in Vermont, wrote for us a few years ago. He's a sort of scraggly Yankee Vermonter who did a tough mudder with some family. And he kind of gave his cranky Vermonter description of the experience. So if you're looking for that, you can check that out on the site. It was pretty funny. And one of the criticisms that he talks about, and I've seen levied at obstacle course racing, is how hyper-commercialized it's become. And I went to the Spartan Race a few years ago, and I was just amazed about all these different things the Spartan Race has to offer now. It's not just a race. You can go sign up with a Spartan Race trainer. You can go on Spartan Race cruises. There's Spartan Race racing shoes. Was that another criticism you came across when you were doing the research for this documentary?
Well, I do appreciate your voice of dissent, or, you know, a healthy measure of cynic in the film. And, you know, you're not alone. I think there's Mark Morford is a culture critic for the SF Gate, SF Chronicle. And he, you know, he's not against it. He questions the motivations of people doing this. And also, like, he sees it as an extreme form of, like, white privilege that we go out there and we get tear gassed just a little bit, but in this, like, safe kind of controlled environment. So, you know, that was a reoccurring criticism that I would hear, is like, we're just playing army. You know, there's no, you can walk off at any point and get a beer, but you feel like you want to pretend that you're playing army. And then obviously the narcissism of it all, it's like it feeds into that whole, like, lead generation. And here we are posting photos of ourselves and, you know, some people take it really way too far they get very culty and I guess self-righteous. And so there are, you know, those elements in any community, really, where they just take things too seriously. So I think for the general public, we can come across as this, people outside of this tribe might not understand why we do this. And there's this line that JC Hertz, who you interviewed for I actually encountered her through your podcast, didn't make it into the film, but she's talking about CrossFit. And it also applies to OCR. She said, like, CrossFit was the first thing that made her empathize with evangelical Christians. Because when you feel like you have found, like, of course you want to tell everyone about it. And so I think a lot of people who find obstacle racing, it's such an extreme thing in this little subculture that they broadcast it maybe a little bit too much and, you know, can rub some people the wrong way.
One of the other criticisms I've seen levied at obstacle course racing is how hyper-commercialized it's become. I went to a Spartan race a few years ago, and I was amazed about all the different things Spartan Race has to offer now. It's not just the race. You can sign up with a Spartan Race trainer. You can go on Spartan Race cruises. You can buy Spartan Race racing shoes. Was that another criticism you came across when you were doing the research for this documentary?
From you, absolutely. And sure, I mean, but the way I look at it is, yeah, they're absolutely trying to build lifestyle brands and empires. But, you know, ultimately selling something that's, like, hard to sell, they're selling pain. They are, you know, I think the ends in this case justify the means. Like, these races are very, very expensive to put on a traveling, you know, global event. So, you know, why shouldn't they be able to market it and, you know, recoup costs and get sponsorships? And, like, to me, everything in our world is so sponsored and commercialized. Like, you can't drive down the Sunset Strip in Los Angeles without having ads in your face in every direction. So to me, it doesn't feel any more egregious than just life in Western civilization, you know?
Right, right. There will be podcast ads in this podcast, just so you know. So there you go. You make an interesting point, because I think a lot of people you know, don't understand this. They see these companies, they're making boo-koodles of money. Tough Mudder is a $70 million a year company. But what I don't think a lot of people realize is that they're not making much profit. These things are really, really expensive to put on, not only building the course, but insuring it and all that stuff.
Right, of course. And then, you know, the money they, back in the day in 2009 or 10, you know, Tough Mudder has definitely benefited from dirt cheap Facebook ads. It was very easy back then to reach potential customers. And now, you know, to run ad campaigns, it's obviously very expensive to hit even a fraction of their 5 million Facebook fans apiece. So, you know, there's a lot of marketing costs, there's a lot of insurance costs, there's a lot of, you know, and then, you know, they're building multiple properties. Like Spartan Race has a TV show on NBC now. Tough Mudder, and they also have one on NBC Sports. Tough Mudder is, you know, they just announced a TV show on CBS, World's Toughest Mudder, which will debut, I think, on Christmas Day and air throughout 2017 on CBS Sportsnet. So, you know, they're becoming these multimedia businesses, and, you know, there's a lot of cost to scaling these things up.
Right. So speaking of that, the idea of the cost of to scale these things, what's the future of obstacle course racing? I mean, let's talk about this first. Do you think it's going to continue to grow, or is this some sort of cultural trend that will peter out? You know, it's not going to grow much more, but it will still be with us in the background, sort of like CrossFit.
It's a good question. I feel like, well, globally, this is definitely growing and spreading and picking up rapidly in markets. In the US, I believe Tough Mudder is probably, you know, level at the moment, and I think Spartan Race might be growing incrementally. But those days of the explosive, massive growth, you know, we're not going to see that unless, let's say, my documentary, like, you know, touches some nerve and a lot of people see it and, you know, feel inspired to do it, like in the way that, let's say, you know, Born to Run had there's a massive spike in ultra running after that book came out. So short of anything, some kind of miracle like that, I don't see. A lot of people have made up their mind that we're crazy. You know, say for every one person who does obstacle racing, we have 5 or 10 friends who think we're crazy. And those 10 or 8 friends, whatever it is, have made up their mind they would never do it. I think, like, you know, this film might have the power to demystify mud and bring cynics into the space, thereby growing the sport. But short of that, like, I don't think it will go away, because I feel like it scratches an itch for, quite frankly, I feel like this is a symptom of a society that's out of step. Like, this wouldn't exist 50 years ago. This doesn't exist in parts of the world where are daily challenges. And so, you know, it's a symptom, but it's also kind of an antidote. It does scratch the itch that people are missing. Hannah Rosen, who's in the film, she wrote The End of Men. I'm sure you're familiar with her. She had this, like, pretty interesting insight. She said she's from Israel, and she didn't think Tough Mudder would hold any appeal in Israel because, you know, military service is mandatory. And Tough Mudder is just kind of like the background of your life. Like, when you're in high school, you go on these adventure training sessions. And you know, she just didn't think that they wouldn't need this outlet. But because of the way, at least, our life is structured now, we kind of need this outlet. If the zombie apocalypse comes, no one's going to be paying to do a Tough Mudder. You know, like, if things happen in the world around us and, you know, we have life changes because of global warming or whatever, you know, this will go away. But other than that, I kind of feel like it's here to stay. And I also think, you know, Spartan Race could build this into an Olympic sport. I would not be surprised to see obstacle racing in the Olympics in 10, 20 years.
Yeah, I know that's one of Joe DeSena's goals. Do you think he's actually going to make that happen? Do you think people will actually want to say, like, I want to go to a Spartan Race and watch? Or is it one of those events, you know, in the Olympics where people aren't really watching, but it's going on and it's got some legs?
Well, it'd have to change completely for it to be an Olympic sport. You'd have to get rid of a lot of the things that make Spartan what it is. But I could absolutely see this. I mean, Spartan Race has some of the very best athletes in the world competing at levels for money. And it's exciting to watch. So I'd be surprised. I'd be more surprised not to see this in the Olympics in some form than to see it. Because, like, you know, you're testing your entire body. And it's, you know, in these, like, kind of fast paced race formats. And it's like, you know, it's like kind of the modern decathlon in some ways.
Right. So talking about the financial viability of obstacle course races, is it getting more expensive to put these on? I mean, is there this expectation that they have to be even bigger each time. And because of that, it's squeezing out the local and regional races.
I think in general, yeah, a lot of those, there was a time where people saw the success of Tough Mudder Spartan Race and everyone was putting on their own obstacle race. And a lot of those have, you know, kind of shaken out. And even some big brands that came in with a ton of money, like Battle Frog, they have a show on ESPN now. They came in with millions and millions of dollars, but they came in late and they had, you know, branding and they, I'm guessing they must have lost $5 million at least over the past couple of years. They had $1 million in prize money last year for, you know, the elites. They sponsored the Fiesta Bowl. They're the title sponsor for the Fiesta Bowl. They just threw hand over fist money at this and they couldn't ever get any traction. They had, you know, under 1,000 people at these races. So it's very hard for, you know, the little local races will continue. I'm sure they have their local followings, but it's hard for brands at this point to really, there's not much room in the industry. People know what they like and they do those events like Savage Race, Tough Mudder, Spartan, Rugged Maniac, Warrior Dash. Like, you know, they seem sustainable to me.
So I feel like the few times I've been to a Warrior Dash, it hasn't done as well like the past few years.
I went to the Warrior Dash World Championship to see, you know, the athletes, but I have not done a Warrior Dash. And yeah, that's a brand I don't think is, you know, they're scaling down as opposed to up.
They have. Yeah. It's not hard. It's like that fun, like the beer thing. You go and you dress up, you have a beer. I guess people want more. They want something more like an actual challenge.
Yeah. It's a good gateway. And it has been for a lot of people. A lot of people would do a Warrior Dash first because it seems less intimidating, but people realize the Tough Mudder and Spartan Race aren't that impossible to do. They probably want the social currency that comes with those brands as opposed to maybe a Warrior Dash.
Right. So Scott, let's say there's a guy listening to this and he's saying to himself, I want to try an obstacle course race. What's the best way to train for one? And this is coming from a guy, let's remember, that does like one a month. So what's the best way to train for these things?
I've become a fan of CrossFit, and I love trail running. I mean, I'd run and I'd do CrossFit and the different grip strength things that come with that, like pull-ups. But you know, if at the very basics, I'd be doing burpees and running, you know, that will get you to the finish line.
All right. That will get you there. Burpees and running. Okay. That's all you need. Well, Scott, where can people watch the film?
On iTunes. You can download it on iTunes. It's available now.
Well, it's a great film. I got to watch it. And I also make an appearance. So if you want to check myself making a fool, go check it out. Hey, Scott, thanks so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Brett.
My guest today is Scott Keneally. He produced, directed the Rise of the Sufferfest, a documentary about obstacle course races. It's available on iTunes. You can find more information at riseofthesufferfest.com. Also, be sure to check out the show notes at aom.is/sufferfest. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy the show, I'd appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. Whatever you use to listen to the podcast helps us out a lot. As always, thank you for your continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.